This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Northwest Indiana Coalition for Public Education, along with Purdue University Northwest, are co-hosting a panel discussion this week as the first of the two, which is entitled Education and Race, Barriers to Learning for Students of Color. It's going to be on Thursday evening. It's going to be a first of a two-part virtual series that looks into education and race. And we have with us three of the participants, including the moderator, for Thursday's event. We have Tony Lux, who's retired Maryville Community School Superintendent. He's also a board member for both the Indiana Coalition of Public Education and the Northwest Indiana Coalition for Public Education. We also have with us a participant, Mike Berta, who's the retired superintendent of the community schools in Portage and in Valparaiso. And we have with us Dr. Danny Lackey. He is the director of diversity and student services with the Maryville School Corporation. And gentlemen, thank you all for joining us here on the program today.
Glad to be
here. Good morning. Thank you.
Well, Dr. Lux, if you will, tell us about your role as the moderator and tell us more about this event coming up with Thursday evening's first of the two virtual series.
Okay. Very happy to. The Northwest Indiana Coalition for Public Education is a grassroots group that advocates for equity for all children in public education. We're pretty much primarily involved in monitoring legislation that affects public education, whether it helps it or hurts it, and try to get information out to the public about what is happening in the State House. This year, with the pandemic, with the fact that this week is National Public Education Week, and looking at issues that have racial justice issues that have popped up across the country over the last few years, the focus of the group is looking at the complexities that are involved with the education of students of color. I think everybody understands that there are achievement gaps among students related to race, related to wealth. And it's a very complex, multifaceted situation that educators who are constantly giving their best efforts to close those achievement gaps, and also to the general public, that they need to be aware of the challenges that are involved. And when we look at students of color across the country, across Indiana, and especially Northwest Indiana, we begin to recognize the several levels of issues that are involved. And the purpose of this webinar is to look at many of the various facets that that affect student education. We know that there are external barriers to learning, situations that have to do with family and community, economics, health, school funding. And the Indiana Youth Institute is going to give a presentation based on their kids count research and data information about the factors that affect students of color across the state and in Northwest Indiana. We're also going to look at internal barriers that take place within a school to student learning. There are social emotional issues that students face, student perceptions of what their experiences are. Relationships among teachers and students and students to students. And then school programs, the availability of advanced classes for students of color, availability versus somewhat limited accessibility at times, as well as school policies and regulations that can affect the learning programs and enhancing learning, or maybe even being a hindrance to learning for students of color. And then we'll look at some of the issues involved in school funding, which very much of a concern in terms of equitable funding and inequities among schools that serve higher numbers, higher percentages mm-hmm. of students of color. So that's an overview of what the program is.
That sounds interesting. Superintendent Berta, obviously, since you've had the opportunity with the experience of two school corporations here in Northwest Indiana at Portage and Valparaiso, you have a lot to add to the conversation on Thursday, don't you?
Well, I hope so. Mm-hmm. I hope to bring some of that experience to the conversation. So much of what I've experienced in terms of the notion of race and its impact in schools, so much of it has to do with relationships, relationship building. You know, we have all these discussions that are going on across the country about race, about equality, about biases, and so on. It just seems to me that it's important for our students to have those discussions in school. When our kids come to school, they don't leave all of what's going on outside of the school. They don't leave that out of the schoolhouse door. They bring it with them. Mm-hmm. And in fact, as Tony just mentioned, a lot of what they bring with them, they live every day. So this notion of relationship building is very important to me. And then secondly, I hope to bring to the discussion what we've built on in the agenda that Dr. Lux just explained, a discussion about systemic racism and how over time some of these elements have embedded themselves in different parts of our culture, including the schools. You know, the impact of poverty, the impact of disciplinary practices on students, assignment of students to different levels of classes and how that's done, the whole notion of equality versus equity, if you will. So to that point, to listen to the students, we developed a series of five questions that we sent out to the schools in Northwest Indiana seeking responses to these questions about how students see what's being discussed in the country today and how they see that as potential barriers to their education. So we'll be discussing that at the webinar, the results of what the students have responded, and hopefully that's going to build on the second seminar in terms of what actions can we take to help remedy some of this. Mm-hmm.
Now, Dr. Lackey, since you deal with these issues every single day with your job as the Director of Diversity and Student Services at the Maryville School Corporation, you probably feel that you're not only going to put something into the mix on a daily, I guess, real-time basis, what you experience just about every day these days, and will probably be able to take something away as well.
Absolutely. I'm really excited about this event taking place because we need to have a space or a platform to where we can have these discussions and begin to address some of the inequities that we see in school systems in a way that make a difference for kids. I can tell you here in Maryville, and it's kind of reflecting on what Mike mentioned a moment ago, the importance of being able to have those kinds of conversations for our students too. And in order for our students to have those kinds of conversations, our teachers have to have those conversations mm-hmm. as well. That is especially true for school systems where you have a population of minority majority students and the staff does not reflect the same demographics. Mm-hmm. It becomes even more important that teachers have the opportunity to develop the skill sets that they're going to need to be able to be comfortable in having these kinds of conversations. You know, last summer we had, you know, these social justice issues that came up because of events in our society, something that very much touches our students. And when you talk about students of color, definitely they want to talk about these issues. And so you want to make sure that your teachers feel comfortable and have the skill sets necessary to really turn those moments into teachable moments for students. And they are definitely ones that can be accessed in doing that. We just need to make sure that we provided the resources, the supports, and the skill sets needed in order for that to happen. And that takes time, and you have to be purposeful about it. It's not going to happen naturally. You've got to come up with a plan of how you want to see this evolve so that you can create the safe climate that's necessary in order to be able to have some of these difficult conversations.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like, gentlemen, that you all are very much welcome to talk with whoever's participating in the special event that's coming up on Thursday evening. And Dr. Lux, I know you mentioned earlier at the outset of our conversation about the IYI staff being involved in bringing the latest data from the Kids Count data book into the picture. Are there any other presenters that are going to be involved that will probably offer their views and some other things to add to the mix as well?
Yes, we have some outstanding participants with wonderful expertise and years of experience. As I mentioned, the Indiana Youth Institute, the Vice President of Data Analytics and Research, Alicia Kielmovich, is going to do that presentation.
Mm-hmm.
We also have Dr. Patricia Payne, who is the director of the Indianapolis Public Schools Racial Equity Initiative. She is going to talk about relationships among teachers and student-to-student relationships. We also have Dr. Hardy Murphy, who is the clinical professor of urban education leadership and policy studies from IUPUI, and he is also a former superintendent from Evanston, Illinois. He works with school systems around the state of Indiana through the university, and he's going to look at school policies and regulations that can sometimes harm education of and be barriers to education for students of color, and then policies and regulations that can, you know, definitely overcome many of those barriers. Then as a wrap-up, we're going to have Mr. Milton Reed, who's the executive director from Global Consulting Solutions here in Northwest Indiana. He also works with school systems. And he is going to be our segue into where do we go from here after looking at these multifaceted elements that are barriers to learning for students of colors. What can school administrations and school boards and teachers, where can they turn in terms of developing tools and skills to better reach students of color and reduce those achievement gaps?
Well, it sounds like a great presentation from all going to be involved in this on Thursday evening. We should mention that the panel discussion, which will be available online, begins at 7 o'clock in the evening. And it's going to be not only on the Purdue Northwest YouTube channel, it's also going to be live streamed on the Facebook page for the Northwest Indiana Coalition of Public Education. And Dr. Lux, I know that you'll have opportunities, too, that if you want to directly get involved, that you can sign up to be registered for the event. Will you tell us more about that?
Yes, that can be done through Eventbrite. And there is a, if people would just type in NWICPE on Facebook, do a search, that'll take you to a link. And there's a QR code, and there's, or just to go on to Eventbrite. And people can register. There's no charge, and it's an educational program, and so people can log in and follow along. We expect it to be about an hour or so of presentation, followed by some discussion and question and answers.
Well, gentlemen, it sounds like it's going to be a great presentation coming up here on Thursday evening and the follow-up presentation next month, April 15th as well, to talk about the issues of barriers to learning for students of color here in Northwest Indiana. And the best of luck to all participating in this, and we hope that our listeners that have heard what we're hearing about today will be interested and get signed up whatever way they wish to be either a participant or to be a watcher and listener to all this. And Tony Lux and Mike Berta and Danny Lucky, thank you all for being with us to talk about it today.
You're welcome. Thank you, Chris.
Mike Berta.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Mike Berta is retired superintendent for the Portage and Valparaiso schools. Tony Lux is also a retired superintendent for the Merrillville School District, and he's participant of the Indiana Coalition of Public Education. Danny Lackey also works for the Merrillville School Corporation. He's the director of diversity and student services, and they're all going to be participating or hosting and participating in the upcoming event on Thursday called Education and Race, Barriers to Learning for Students of Color, and it'll be visible online. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
When I was in elementary school, my mom was a stay-at-home mom, so she did all the classroom parties. She was around helping all the time, and I look exactly like my mom. And she's half Mexican, so we both have our darker skin tone. My friends and all my classmates would see, oh, that's your mom? You guys are so much tanner. And I'd come back from the summer and have this nice tan that would hold up most of the school year. And these other kids didn't. And so they just were like, oh, like, what? And they at first they'd be like, are you Italian? Are you this? And parents would do this too. Parents would be like, what are you? And finally I was like, you know what? Like, my dad's 100 different things. Like, I tried to make like this, it was like, I think it was a pie chart for one of my classes in high school. And it was just split 100 different ways, like so many different ways. And my dad has really no idea what he is. We kind of guesstimated. And my mom only knows the part that's Mexican. So that's my majority. And so eventually they were like, what are you? And I'm like, well, I'm Hispanic or Mexican. And I don't really know what else. I think just growing up, they just knew like, you're tan. You said you were from you have your grandpa's from Mexico, so you must be Hispanic and you're different. I mean, they didn't treat me differently. I never felt like I was treated differently, but I definitely stood out being like a heavy tan kid in elementary school when I had these skinny white girls all around that were just pale and straight hair and just, I mean, I stood out. It's different because my boyfriend is Czechoslovakian because his grandpa's from Czech and his other grandma's from Czech, and then his other grandma and grandpa are from Slovak, and that was the same country. And it's so funny to see the two grandparents will come together for like Christmas or holidays and they will argue and be like, that's a stupid Czech thing. And I'm like, what are you talking about? That is the same thing. And it's just so weird. When we started dating, I couldn't understand them. And now I'm like, I can understand them clearly. I'm like, hey, Baba. And I was like, introduce, this is Baba. That's Slovak for grandma. Like, and I started eating noodles with cottage cheese the other day. My mom was like, can you just go move with the Slovaks? And I was like, yeah, Mom. Like, I don't know what to tell you. So it's like different that even though like I've only known them for 3 years, I've started picking up on their culture habits. And I think it's amazing that he knows what he is. And he has that full-on, I'm Czechoslovakian, but not a lot of people have that. I think there's a ton of people that just don't know what they really are. They don't know what if they're Polish or German or Irish. I just think there's a big group of people that identify with a lot of different things, and that's what that category is right now. So I don't think there's a strictly white category. I think that's just the default.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Rick Reifa is the president of the Griffith Town Council, and he is with us on Regionally Speaking today to give us an update on some of the projects and topics of interest within the town. And as always, Rick, thank you for joining us on the show today.
All right, great. Thanks for having me.
Let's take a look here at the discussions that are underway and the official handling, I guess, of an airport advisory commission to look into taking over the Griffith Merrillville Airport. That's a nifty little airport that is nicely tucked away on the east edge of Griffith on Long Main Street. And probably is one of the well-known secrets, certainly of Lake County, to be sure. How many planes come in and out of the airport on a regular basis?
You know, I think the last numbers I saw were about 40,000 plus per year.
Mm-hmm.
So that some of it is they have a training school there as well, but it is a very very busy airport.
That's what I understand. Yeah. I also understand, of course, the Lake County Sheriff's Department also takes advantage of it too. They run their helicopters out of there too. So it's I guess it, the runways and all get a lot of usage.
Yep. Yeah. Definitely, it does. But. But it happened, you know, several years ago, actually quite some time ago, the FAA and the federal government decided that they really don't want to support privately owned airports anymore. So most people aren't aware, all airports, including private airports, were getting substantial grants from the federal government,
mm-hmm.
or FAA. So that went away a couple years ago. So what they're doing is, in order to be eligible for these grants, you need to be a municipally owned airport. So that's when the owners of the airport approached us a couple years ago to see if we'd be interested in purchasing it. So we, you know, we hired some financial people and attorneys to look at the whole operation. We've got an initial draft of financial report we just received recently. So we're at the point now where we'd like to hire an airport advisory committee, or not hire, but appoint.
Right.
And have them have a second set of eyes look at all the financials. So, you know, people who would be potentially appointed to that, we'd like to have a strong financial background, somebody that has read P&L statements, different revenue and expenditure reports, et cetera. So not necessarily a ton of aviation experience, but somebody with a strong financial background.
What kind of economic impact does the airport have on not only the town of Griffith, but the whole area there in the Calumet Township?
It's tough to put a number on, to be honest with you. There's not a lot of commercial flights, if any, going out of there. So we don't really notice that. I think the potential would be, you know, very, very high if run properly. There's certain things that could be expanded. The runway needs to be expanded, get some bigger jets in there. So there's great growth opportunity there. But mm-hmm. our main objective right now is to look and see if we go ahead and proceed with the purchase. We want, one, we don't want our taxpayers to have to fund any operations there should things go bad or not to be what the numbers are expected. And two is we want to be able to grow it. And be able to grow it with hopefully you know, with the additional federal assistance or state assistance in order to make some improvements.
Now, you mentioned that, I guess, if it becomes a municipally owned airport, then at least you'd have opportunities to take advantage of FAA grants. Would there be any other financial help that might come from even, we'll say, across the state line from Illinois, since I guess it is kind of a reliever for Midway in some flights, I would imagine. They might be able to help out some financially.
I wouldn't count on that, but okay. I'm not ruling it out. It hasn't been brought up in the discussions, but I'd be surprised, you know, we've got the Gary Airport there, they've got a Lansing Airport, et cetera.
So I suppose they will have to take a serious look, and this airport advisory committee that you're having created will help take care of that work, I suppose.
Yes, they will. That will be part of it. But the main thing right now is let's look at the financials to make sure this is something that we'll be able to be self-sustainable.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things I wanted to ask you about, Rick, is to find out what the latest is in the town of Griffith's efforts to try to secede from Calumet Township. A lot of that has already gone through the legislature, and some changes I'm sure are going to happen. But what is the latest right now?
Well, actually, all of it has gone through the legislature. If you remember, several years ago, we had a law passed that allowed us to have a referendum, which let citizens decide whether or not they wanted us to leave Calumet Township and join North Township. And at the time, 97% of the voters, which I think was like 3,100 to 69 or something like that, voted yes to do so. So we had a little struggle getting accepted into a township last year. We went downstate. And then an additional law passed that actually put us directly into North Township. So that will take effect on January 1st of 2022.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of this year, Griffith will no longer be in Calumet Township. We will be in North Township. And we're looking at a savings collectively between the taxpayers and money the town and the schools, et cetera, would save via circuit breakers of putting in anywhere from 2.2 to 2.4 million, maybe more this year. So our contribution to North Township would be probably right around $500,000.
Have you got any input yet from besides the initial input from the North Township Board of Trustees about having the town join?
We had several discussions about a year ago, or even less than that. I think as we get closer to the date, then we're obviously going to be reaching out to them and seeing what's going on. They have a new trustee right now, so I anticipate in having discussions with that trustee probably within the next, hopefully, month or so.
One of the other things I wanted to bring up, Rick, is the latest news about economic development in the town of Griffith in particular. It's about taking advantage of the Griffith Park Plaza. We all know that the former Kmart store is a big part of that, the whole shopping center area. But I understand there's a lot of work that's underway right now with new ownership to try to revitalize that, the whole area. Tell us, first off, what the new owners plan to do and what kind of work is going to be underway when the weather breaks.
The new owners that bought it probably closed on it within the last month or so. We've had several discussions with them in the meeting. They're looking at doing a complete renovation of the eastern part of the mall, which is what they own. The mall, the part that the owners own, would be everything, excluding the Kmart store and the Payless Shoes and the outbuildings. So they're looking at completely refurbishing, rebuilding, et cetera, existing buildings. I think the initial thoughts were they could be anywhere from $1 to $3 million put in immediately. I believe the parking lot issues will be addressed as well.
What kind of discussion have you had with the new owners prior to them officially taking over? Did they give you and the rest of the town council a better idea of what they are going to be doing with the space that they're taking over?
No, we had zero discussions with them prior to that. This was a different type of sale.
Mm-hmm.
It was listed as an auction by the old owner. So he auctioned it off, or the company auctioned it, and they received a bid that they were happy with. So they went ahead and wound up closing on the document, or closing on the property. So they simply, they didn't come to us. We didn't offer any TIF dollars or incentives. Before they purchase it, and there's probably not going to be a whole lot available other than maybe helping with the facades or some other type of improvements.
Right. Well, it sounds like it's going to certainly be a great improvement to the area. For the other businesses, will it have a positive impact for them, the ones that are already there in the Griffith Park Plaza?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt that this thing has been run down for many, many, many years. We wish the Kmart building would have sold as well, but that's completely out of our control. The owners of the Kmart building are not Kmart or any affiliation of Kmart. They're a private ownership who purchased it maybe 3 to 5 years ago. So from what I understand, they're still getting rent from Kmart, even though mm-hmm. it's sitting vacant, and they really haven't had any desire to sell at any price for right now. But we'll see what happens over the next few months and years.
Well, certainly hope that does finally develop into something. That's such a great building, great possibility for a building. If it's not so badly run down because it's been unoccupied for a number of years, that certainly somebody should at least entice the owner of the Kmart building now into doing something with it. And let's hope if it does turn out to something, it's done fairly soon. Thank you very much for bringing us up to date, Rick, on what's happening in the town of Griffith. And we'll be back in touch with you soon to find out more.
Right. Okay. Take care.
Take care now. Rick Reifa is a town councilman in Griffith, and he's also president of the town council. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Indiana Youth Institute has once again put out a new Kids Count data book, this time for 2021. Let's find out more about it and where the Hoosier State seems to sit as far as all of the important issues involving young people. We have Tammy Silverman, who's the president and CEO with the IYI, with us. And Tammy, thanks for joining us. And
always my pleasure.
And fill us in, if you will, on some of the data and how Indiana seems to stand for child well-being these days.
Certainly. So overall, we are ranked 29th nationally, which is exactly where we were ranked last year. So part of the challenge there is, what does that, sometimes that means that perhaps we went ahead in a couple categories, which we did, but that other states might have moved ahead quicker than we did. So obviously, 29th out of 50, we would like to be a little higher up than that, and we're going to keep pushing to see what we can do to improve the well-being of our kids in the various, and obviously we look at that by all of this data and the huge data book that's mm-hmm. out there.
Let's take a look at some of the information that's out in some of the categories here. First, fill us in how we're doing as far as child population is concerned.
Yes. So here, Indiana's home to the 15th largest child population. And one of the things we know is that our child population is more diverse than our adult population and is growing increasingly so. So it's important that we pay attention to just over 34% of our kids are a race or ethnicity other than white, and that's about 12% more than the adult population. So we know our kids are significantly more diverse, and so it's important for us to understand that and to look at the data and provide services around that. And again, most of our data throughout the data book is disaggregated by race and ethnicity precisely for that reason. Mm-hmm.
I know we always keep an eye on how the figures are as far as Indiana is concerned and the region for that matter, too. On foster care, how are we doing as far as the IYI is concerned about that topic?
Yes, well, looking at the data, we do know that the number of kids in our foster care system decreased by just over 10%, actually 12.2%. And at the same time, we know that we still have a larger number of kids in the foster care system when you look at many of our neighboring states. Mm-hmm. So we're going in the right direction. That's a significant drop. However, at the same time, there's still more work that we need to do.
Where does it seem that most of the foster placements seem to be these days?
Most of them are still with a non-relative home. And so, you know, that's a foster parent or a foster home that's not grandma, grandpa, that kind of thing. And the average length of stay, to think about this, the average length of stay for the children who exited care was 584 days.
I know we always talk about the possibility that young people, especially those who have unfortunately been involved in the juvenile justice operations around the state, seem to be the most vulnerable to challenges and failure. How did the IYI Kids Count look for 2019 show as far as this?
Sure. We do know that the number of kids that are involved in the juvenile justice system in Indiana has also been decreasing. And so the number of youth incarcerated actually dropped 23.9% since 2017, which is really significant. And so we know that a lot of folks are working on that. We're working with them on that to continue that drop. And at the same time, again, we still know that there's a disproportionate number of children of color that are incarcerated. So, mm-hmm. You know, we need to make sure that there aren't racial disparities going on there, which we know there still are. So we need to address that. We need to see if we can continue to decrease the number of kids in custodial care and make sure that there's an equity lens across the board.
Now, I know you mentioned at the outset of our conversation about Indiana's overall ranking as 29th for child well-being. Where does Indiana stand according to the latest statistics as far as child poverty is concerned?
That is a fantastic question, Chris. And we're doing a little better on child poverty. And this is actually, so we're ranked 23rd in the nation for the percentage of children living in poverty, which is 15.2%. And that's continued to improve the last few years. You know, one of the important things to know about most of these numbers is obviously they're pre-COVID. So we're really paying attention to that child poverty rate because we know, because the economic impact and the disproportionate impacts on people of color with COVID, we're concerned and we're paying attention to that child poverty rate, mm-hmm. for sure, as well as food insecurity rates.
Where does the IYI fill us in on the latest report concerning the topics of child mortality and tobacco use among young people?
Yeah, those are both interesting components because, again, we've been headed in the right direction. So we're seeing some momentum across the state on many of these issues. I feel like I'm kind of a broken record saying moving in the right direction. But we do know that infant mortality rate is improving. But, again, same message. You disaggregate the data, and there's significant disparities for black babies in Indiana. So we need to ensure that all Hoosier kids have the opportunity to grow up healthy and safe, and we need to be paying a little more attention to our babies of color in order to do that and to execute on that goal. Our mm-hmm. tobacco use, again, headed in the right direction, and yet we know that electronic vaping products, no surprise, those have been increasing. So we know that nicotine is nicotine, whether it's coming through a cigarette or a vape product, and we want to make sure that our young people do not get addicted to either one.
Well, Tammy, the last thing that's on the list here as far as the 2021 Kids Count, the data book is concerned from the IYI, bring us up to date on education, and it looks like we're making some improvements. Fill us in on that, please.
We were. That is our highest ranking, where we're ranked 15th in the nation, which is up from 21st just last year. That same thing is pre-COVID, and we know that that has shaken up our entire education system. So we know that we were in a relatively good place going into it, and we hope that we can maintain that while still paying attention to all of our little ones, pre-K all the way up through high school graduation and post-secondary success.
Well, I guess we're not getting higher up in the list as far as the states on some of the areas, but we're improving in others, and that's, I suppose, good news to be sure. And if anybody would like to check out in particular their own particular county's status, how can they do so?
You can go right to our website, which is IYI.org, and there's a snapshot by county. So you can take a look at your home area while also looking at how we're doing as a state collectively.
Well, Tammy, thank you for bringing us up to date on the 2021 Kids Count Data Book, and we will talk with you again soon, I hope.
Sounds great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Tammy Silverman's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. We've gotten the latest on the latest Kids Count Data Book. So that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Back with you tomorrow.